Hi, I'm Ken Skupski, and you're listening to the Functional Tennis Podcast.
Welcome to episode 12 of the Functional Tennis Podcast. This week, we have a great conversation with Ken Skupski. I know Ken going back about 5 years. He actually bought a Christmas jumper from our Christmas jumper business. Crazy. We cover many areas. We cover the advantage of going to college, his winning record against John Isner in college, dreaming, playing and splitting from your bro as a doubles player, life on the tour with three kids, his current success, world team tennis, becoming a better doubles player and much more. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Now let's hear all about it. Hi Ken, welcome to the Functional Tennis Podcast.
Hi mate, how's it going?
Good, great to have you on board. It's been a while. We've been trying to pencil this podcast in, but it's great that we can have a chat with you and find out more about Ken Skupski.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We've talked about this for a while, so it'd be good to have a chat.
Tell me, where are you right now?
I'm in Winston-Salem. It's the lead-up tournament to the US Open. I'm playing tomorrow, so I've got another practice day today, and it's pretty warm outside, so it's a good prep for New York, and looking forward to it.
You were on vacation with your family a few days ago, then you arrived back in Liverpool, and now you're there. How do you deal with obviously the traveling, but with a family? Like, it must be really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's not something that I thought I'd be doing back when I first started playing, traveling with three children. That was been a bit of a difficulty since going from two to three. We've been outnumbered now, but I think my wife's been very understanding of the fact that I've been able to be very productive on the tennis court in the last couple of years. I was a little bit unsure whether I would continue once we had the third child, because we did find it to be quite difficult. We've adapted our lifestyle to sort of make it work at the moment. They don't travel too much abroad. Just financially, it's a lot. And just from a stress perspective, having them around the tennis tournaments and keeping them busy, keeping my wife sort of under control with dealing with the stress of it. It's one of them really difficult sort of balancing things in life that we've managed to figure it out, but it just means that I'm away a lot on my own. Going on holiday was great. It was good to sort of spend just total quality time with them, forget about the tennis. I know it's obviously a difficult time because it's sort of mid-season, but we have to understand that being a dad, you have to, you know, prioritize the family sometimes over the tennis. And I do play a smaller schedule than I used to, but it's actually been productive in terms of my best results have come when I've had, you know, one, two, three children. So it's sort of worked in. I thought it was going to be a bit of a catch-22 that more kids might mean playing less, and I would never be able to make a living out of the sport, but it's gone the other way in some ways. So I'm very happy with the lifestyle that I've got at the moment. And it's just making sure that the body is sort of maintained to a level where I can compete on a week-to-week basis.
Number four, number five, you come along. Imagine what the results are going to be like then.
Don't tell my wife that we're doing a podcast and I'm saying these type of things. Three for me is where I've always said would be the maximum. It would have always been nice to have had a girl. We've always talked about sort of when we first started what type of family we would have liked. A girl would have been nice, especially for my wife. But you can't just keep going down the line. You can't get to six boys and think, let's go for seven. I think three for us is a good number. And again, we're very happy with how things are at the moment. And
that's great to hear. And do you think if one or two kids, you can actually travel to tournaments with them, but any more than that is just really tough? Or do you think one and two can be tough also?
I think it just depends on the type of personality you are and sort of like the lifestyle you lead as a tennis player. I think as a doubles player, you're probably on court a little bit less than a singles guy. I come across obviously other players that travel with kids. Mike Venus, friend of mine from LSU, he's traveling with his wife and daughter, and he seems to be making it work. He's doing very, very well at the moment. That's one. I mean, Bob Bryan's got three children. He's traveling quite a bit. You know, he's still obviously he's had time off with his injury, but back now being productive. And I think it's everybody for themselves. I mean, I can't imagine the certain players out there. You know, tennis is quite a selfish sport in a way, where you've got to focus solely on what you need to do to be, you know, the best you can be on court. And having bad night's sleep, you know, that can affect a lot of players. It's something that I've been very lucky with. I don't find having going to bed at, you know, a reasonable hour, but waking up at 5 a.m. not to stress me out. And I sort of dealt with it. You know, I've done it this morning, woke up at 5:20, and, you know, no kids here, but it's fine for me. I felt like I had a good enough sleep. So I'm about, you know, getting on with the day. And yeah, it's every man for himself. But people do it and people are productive with it. So, you know, it's something that I feel like I've adapted to over the years. And, you know, having a good base with wife and grandparents, you know, some people have nannies that travel. Yeah, they make it work and obviously balance the life of being a tennis player.
For me, it looks like just from the outside, the financial sense, the financial cost of it makes a big difference. Like you talk about the Bryan brothers have three and they probably have a few nannies with them as well. Probably a big team. So obviously if you're winning the Grand Slams over a long course period and the income is big, it must make it a lot easier to be able to do it.
Yeah, and I can imagine different ages of the kids make a difference as well, how much attention then what daddy does. I'm not 100% sure how many weeks Bob travels with his kids, but I do see his wife seems to be alone quite a lot, but they're of an age now where they can,
yeah.
Some of them have iPads and they seem pretty active and they can sort of look after themselves in a way. I think if you're dealing with children very, very young, you know, there's a lot of attention, but then, you know, it depends on how active your wife is, yeah. In terms of, you know, getting up and out and to do things on her own with the kids. Financially, I can imagine, you know, you have the luxury of being able to have people come along, but I've always wanted them to come along, but knowing that the more that they come, yeah. Maybe the more stressful it is for them to be at a tournament and there's not much going on. So then I sort of feel like guilty that they're just sort of in a hotel room, and I've sort of picked and choose where the best places to come and traveling with a car in the UK.
True. Yeah, true. I did see it was a Fernando Verdasco had a newborn at Roland Garros and he was getting photos taken with everybody and he was showing up at all the practice sessions. It was quite funny. So let's see how long that lasts.
I think it's a little bit easy because you put them in a pram, they eat, they sleep and things aren't too easy. It's once they become mobile and you've got multiple, then things start to become.
By the time this podcast airs in a few weeks, Ken, my wife had our first baby. So it's all ahead of me. It's all new to me. I'm looking forward to it, but I'm sure it'll be stressful at times.
Yeah,
it's going to be great. So, but your best results have come in the past few years. And since when you said you didn't know what was going to happen with your career with more kids, why do you feel your results have got better?
Look, just going back to when I first came onto the tour, I started playing.
That's Flemsky, isn't it?
Flemsky. Back in 2009.
Yeah.
Yeah, Flemsky. Flemsky back in the day. Yeah. So it was, we sort of came on this, I mean, all guns blazing. We got up to top quite quickly. A couple of tour events in the first few months of our sort of getting to the ATP tour level. So I think we were a little bit naive once we got there to sort of know how the system worked and what the best ways of doing things. It wasn't until we sort of split that we started to realize, you know, how the tour worked, what the best things to do, whether to split up to get into the bigger events. And there was a few things that I regret back in the day, but, you know, I had a little bit of success with different players down the line, played a bit with Xavier Malisse, Delgi, and enjoyed, you know, playing with all these different players. But it wasn't until I sort of took the decision to play with Neil, who's just come out of college and was ranked down at like 700. I think I may have been maybe just outside 100 and sort of was a little bit unsure how to sort of progress my career again, that I got the stability of getting Neil up to the ranking that was required for the ATP level. And, you know, we had an okay sort of 2 or 3 years, but it all sort of tied in when we changed sides. I'd always been I'm obviously a lefty, but I've always played on the ad side, not thinking too much about ever switching sides until we just sort of got, we were a bit, you know, stagnant in the rankings, almost got a bit bored of the way we were playing because we knew we could beat certain teams. We'd always struggle against the teams who had a sort of a little bit more armory about them, a bit more craft. And we sort of just, you know, bit the bullet, changed sides. Ever since then, we'd sort of had a great run. And I think, you know, subtle little differences of moving sides gave us sort of the freedom to play a little bit more expressive. And I found sort of small little areas in terms of like moving onto the forehand volley instead of both of us moving onto the backhand volley just gave us an extra little bit of stretch. Again, the stronger forehands were in the middle rather than on the outside. So, you know, small little things like that made a massive impact on the way we were playing. And obviously playing well builds confidence, you know, ranking improves. And then it's just unfortunate that in some ways that Neil, obviously, you know, when you're playing well together, you know, people always think that you're not going to ever split up as a brother. But, you know, I'm 6 years. It's not like Bob and Mike where they're sort of, you know, they've grown up together and had so much success. It's unrealistic to think that they would ever split because that being joint number one in the world was what's the point in ever splitting. When you're ranked at 40 or 50, you know, if there's an offer that comes along that jumps you from playing, you know, 250, maybe a 500 to being almost seeded at Master Series, you know, seeded at Grand Slams. I'm not stupid. I'm a realistic guy. I very much look out for my brother and I'm 36. So there's not like there's a massive amount of time left for me, I would say. I just looked at it from the perspective, you know, me, Neil and I sat down together and we sort of talked through all the different variables, you know, the pros and cons. And I just said to him, look, these type of offers don't necessarily come along very often. And, you know, Jamie's a very experienced player. He's had a lot of success and, you know, he's very much, you know, in control of, you know, his own destiny with being top 10 in the world. And I said, Neil, look, you've got to take take this opportunity to sort of advance your career. And maybe, you know, we're within 12 months of playing an Olympics, and it would be nice. I mean, obviously Jamie could potentially play with Andy, but it would be nice if Neil and Jamie did have that success to then maybe play in them big events. But, you know, I've sort of got to accept that my role is slightly changed now because I'm playing with different players and I'm currently playing with Marcus Daniel. But you never know what happens in doubles. You never know how the future may turn out. And we could find ourselves back together at one point. I never thought I'd be playing with someone else. I thought I would retire playing with Neil, but that's not the case. But yeah, just, you know, subtle little technical changes and tactical changes was probably the main reason. And also a different mindset of, you know, being a bit more relaxed, even though I've got more kids. I found playing tennis a little bit more relaxing, going away, yeah. You know, sort of getting a little bit of extra, you know, me time may be a reason for it as well. But, you know, it's amazing how your mindset, you'd wish you had the same mindset now and knowledge, you know, when you first start, but obviously that's not the case. And I'm just enjoying that, you know, I love the sport. I want to stay in the sport and I'm just going to take advantage of every opportunity I get to sort of play at this level and maybe go on and play bigger tournaments in the future.
It must be an age thing, though, that relaxes you a bit. You don't get stressed out as much. You've been in the situation many more times. So, you know, how, you know, everything's just a bit calmer, heart rate's lower, and it means you execute better. I think it's.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not 100% sure, but if you look at the Filip Polasek at the moment, I mean, he's having an incredible year, having been out of the game for 5 years. You know, he was talking I heard an interview with him yesterday. You know, it's sort of like his second chance and so much more focused, so much more relaxed, you know, a bit more mature on tour and he's just enjoying it. You know, it's not life or death losing tennis matches. You know, you'll always have another chance potentially, you know, the following week to sort of improve your ranking. And it's so clear to me that if you lose a tennis match but give your best effort, that's all you can ask for. You know, you learn from it and you try again the next week.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think as a young guy, today only, you don't think of the future. It's like probably upsets take a lot longer to get over.
Yeah, you get too wrapped up in the moment. Also, I think as a person outside of tennis, you know, I have to deal with so many more elements of life now rather than just the tennis tour. I quite enjoy getting away from the tennis because it just gives you a little bit more of a relaxation of life. I think too many people sort of live the life of a tennis player. And even when they're on their off weeks, they're still in the tennis bubble. I think it's from my perspective, if I moved on to the coaching, I'd try to get players to take more time away from the court and sort of have a different, like a network of friends away from tennis, just to sort of get away from it. Because I find I get more excited then when I come back to it, a bit more of a fresh headspace. And you don't realize that until you've been away from the game for a few days.
I know you're a big golf player, and do you have a handicap of 6, is it, or has it gone
down? I probably played to that handicap more so when I was playing college because I got to play a little bit more. Now I'm probably maybe 9 or 10, but I'm enjoying the opportunities that I still get to play because I'm playing on some nice courses while I'm on tour.
So yeah, that must be good to just get your mind off things and just completely relax, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I probably would never have thought of playing a round of golf during a tennis tournament, but over the years, I've found it a little bit more of a way, again, short term to, you know, have a morning practice and then get away from the tennis, have a game of golf in the afternoon, sort of refocus, you know, enjoy socially with the guys. You know, I play golf with my brother, Johnny O'Mara, and other British guys. They all play golf to a decent level. So we can sort of enjoy, you know, a bit of banter with the guys, not talking about tennis. And it's a nice way to sort of have a, I wouldn't say a team chemistry.
You mentioned Johnny O'Mara there. I was at that match you won at Roland Garros this year, the Battle of the Brits. I thought it was a great match. You and your brother were impressive. The best I haven't seen played too many times now, but I thought that was an impressive victory. You really took them apart.
I mean, we had a bit of a rivalry last year because they were beating us 4 times in a row. So, you know, it's tough playing against friends. That's a difficult thing. But you sort of have to, you know, be professional. You go on, you do your thing. And we played a great match. We'd had a great clay court season. It's something that I'm very proud of because it's a surface that I would say I was very poor on early part of my career just for the fact that I'd never really grown up on the surface. And Neil and I had put a great run together leading into the French. And again, difficult to play against them guys, but we knew they'd had a little bit of a tough time recently. And we sort of thought, you know, if we can get ahead early, which we did a very good job of. And it, you know, everything came together on the day.
Yeah, it was great to watch with some unbelievable tennis. So you briefly mentioned singles there. When you were going to take it back to when you were a junior now, were you a junior player? It was always singles and you went to LSU University of Louisiana. When you started at Louisiana, were you a singles player?
I think if you go back even further to when I was a kid, I grew up at Palmerston Tennis Club. We played a lot of social doubles. My week-to-week training was a lot of the time playing with club members. I'm talking when I'm 10 years old, 11 years old. I would be playing a lot of club doubles. I would be very sort of comfortable on the doubles court. And, you know, as the years went by, you know, my dad put me into a lot of singles events and I felt I was progressing. I was one of the top 8, maybe top 5 British players in my age group. But I always had a sense in the back of my mind, I was probably a chubby kid. So I was probably never the fittest tennis player in the world. And my game style sort of reflected that. I mean, I was a very attacking player. I liked to come forward, you know, having the comfortable situation of playing a lot of doubles. It sort of worked well with my game. But going into sort of the latter part of my junior career, it was, you know, I was very accustomed to playing a lot of singles at that point. Making the quarterfinals of Junior Wimbledon was sort of a good stepping stone to college. It sort of gave, you know, some of the college coaches an idea that I was capable of playing good tennis. But I was national champion under 18 doubles a year young and my final year under 18. So I always knew that doubles was probably the better of the two. You always want to dream of playing singles. So you know, as you go through college, you know, I was good at both. Had a good junior career. I went into college with lot of hopes and aspirations to continue playing singles and had some great results. I mean, I got to, I think, nationally ranked number 4 at one point. I think Georgia were very much a better established team, but I found myself sort of excited about the rivalry that we were, you know, we had. I mean, John, obviously he's gone on to have an unbelievable career, but during his college days, I felt like I could get him. I felt like my game style sort of worked pretty well against him. And I got to play against him 4 times. So I won 2, lost 1. And I think we were all square. I think we played a team match where the team had lost, but our match was unfinished. So that we didn't get to finish the match. So having a winning record against someone of his stature, that's always something to reflect on. Very nice. We do have a little talk about it every often, you know, as we see each other at tournaments, but he always loves to reflect on the fact that we played each other 10 times in doubles in college and he beat me all 10 times, which I didn't really want to mention there, but I think he would, if he ever heard the podcast, he would want to, you know, find a way to get that information across. So we do have a bit of banter about it and it is great fun that, you know, I think we played each other in the NCAA final, which was probably the biggest match that we played against each other. And typical John, we had set points, I think, in at least one of the sets. I think it was 7-5, 7-6. Typical John Isner ace to sort of, you know, ruin the party. So yeah, that was great times, but it's something that we reflect on in you know, in a good way. John played with Antonio Ruiz, who he did play professional afterwards for a short time, a Mexican guy. And then I was playing with a British guy, Mark Grocott, from sort of Birmingham way. I don't think he ever really went on to play professional. He did play a lot of professional tournaments, I think, during his college career back in the UK during the summertime. But he stayed in education. I think he got his master's and I think he still lives over in Louisiana. And it was a bit of a man-wife relationship. There was a lot of arguing going on between us. We sometimes didn't see eye to eye about things, but we were very productive on the court and had some great wins. And things I reflect on.
At LSU, I know James was there. Michael Venus was there. Your brother was there. Were you there when your brother was there?
No, I'm 6 years older. So when I graduated, there was a year gap between the time that he became an LSU Tiger. Jimmy Klusk, he sort of overlapped both of us, and so did Michael Venus. The only problem with Michael Venus was he was ineligible the year I was there because he transferred in from the University of Texas and he had to sit out a year of his tennis college career to sort of become eligible for our team. So I obviously got to know Mike for a year, but we never played together. I was playing with Jimmy and we had a good relationship, good partnership, and you know, we still keep in touch and we're good friends.
Have you played with James? Did you play with him at all on after college in any events?
I'm trying to think. I don't think we did. I think my ranking had sort of got to a stage where it was, we didn't see each other at, yeah, you know, that many tournaments, and I was very much established with Neil at the time, so it was obviously a difficult situation for him. But we did spend a bit of time, you know, as the years went by at some of the challenger tournaments, and I think he was able to play a couple of ATPs before he called it a day.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time, he's working hard, he's doing well for himself, so yeah, he'll do well whatever he's working on next. He knows every player out there, and he's a relationship with everyone. He's amazing how he does it. I don't know how he does it, but it's amazing. Did you ever play in the event in Dublin? Maybe it was a challenger in the early days.
There was a challenger at Fitzwilliam, which I did play. It was the only challenger, if I remember rightly, it was the only challenger I qualified for. So yeah, I did play it. I grew up on AstroTurf, artificial grass. So it was a surface that I was very much, you know, I enjoyed playing on. But I just never, once I turned professional and played singles, I had some decent results at the sort of the futures level, but never really broke through at the challenger level. It's something I would say I regret a little bit. I probably could have done a bit better, but I just knew looking around, seeing all the other guys play, I just knew I was never, ever going to compete, you know, at the top end of the challenger level. And I thought, well, what's the point? You know, some people probably play tennis for a little bit too long and are not realistic about what they can achieve. And I just sort of knew that doubles was probably the thing for me. So I gave singles up very quickly when I sort of felt I was not capable of making any money out of the sport. I sort of maximized my chances of making as much money as I could and doing as well as I could in doubles. You know, I think it must have been maybe around about the age of 25. Worked well for me. It might not work well for everybody else. And you know, some people think they should continue and maybe sort of in the back of their minds know they've got the capabilities of doing it, but it was just not for me. I was just not capable of playing at that level consistently. I mean, physically probably wasn't there. It was the right decision for me. And it's, you know, I was glad I made that decision.
And just before you made the decision, when you finished up in Louisiana, was it like 100% I'm going pro, or was there any doubt saying I'm going to get a job or travel a bit? Or were you just convinced I'm going pro?
No, I always wanted to play. My reasoning to go for college was I knew at the age of 18 when I finished my junior career that I wasn't ready to play professional tennis. I'd seen too many guys play professional, you know, almost retire by the age of 21 when they're not fully established, just because they were burnt out. They'd lost too many matches. They hadn't broke the gap between futures and challengers. And I thought, you know, I'd like to continue my education. You know, you get a degree at the end of it, potentially you become part of a team environment, which I, you know, going back to county week, playing junior county events, I love the team environment. And I think that's also, you can correlate that to doubles as well. Like, I enjoyed sharing things with people, you know, sharing the success, playing for others. College was the best thing that ever happened for me because I was able to mature as a person, develop my game, play an awful lot of tennis. I mean, the degree that I did was it was an easy degree. So I didn't have to spend too many hours sort of studying. I got better at sort of planning my time so I could maximize my time spent on court. And it was, you know, as soon as my results shown in college that I was able to compete against good players at that level, I knew it was the right thing that I'd done, and it was the right sort of stepping stone to the professional game, because I graduated at 23, and it was a good age to sort of move into the professional game. You know, I can't say anything about college tennis that I didn't enjoy, and I would advise a lot more people to consider it unless there's an obvious sign that there's, you know, they're going to bridge the gap between futures and challengers quickly, because you can easily get bogged down at futures level. And if you do that, it's mental torture at times, because you know you're out in these small countries on your own at times, and it can really get you mentally rather than, you know, anything else, you know. And it's a difficult sport, and I've seen it so many times with players that they just can't sort of bridge that gap, whether that's physically, mentally, tactically, financially. And college is a great way to sort of establish everything before you get into the game, to sort of progress your level pretty quickly through the futures level.
Yeah, I agree with you there with college as a stepping stone. I've seen what some of the facilities are like. You have a coaching team around you, fitness guys, physios, all the apparel you could want, the team environment, the enthusiasm. It doesn't get much better than that by the looks. But I say it can be tough leaving college. I know while you're playing college, you can play futures in the summertime. So you can actually leave college with a decent, with a good ranking, with a good ATP Tour ranking. But I'd say it's tough if you leave college and then you're going straight to futures. It can be even tougher again.
I mean, from the other side of things, from a academic side, you walk away with a degree, you know, and you have some type of protection if the world of tennis doesn't work for you. You know, not everybody wants to stay in the sport afterwards. Yeah. You know, not everybody wants to be a tennis coach. You know, that there are definitely other avenues in the tennis world that you could pursue.
What's the degree in, if you don't mind me asking?
But tennis coaching is not for everybody. And I just felt, you know, it was a degree. Okay. I wouldn't say it's the best degree. I can't really use it necessarily for that much. But, you know, I'm proud of the fact that I have a degree, and it's at least given me some type of, you know, buffer in case tennis didn't work out. It's the study of generals. It's general studies. It's not a, it's a bog standard degree, I found. It was the degree that sort of gave me the most opportunity to be on the tennis court on my day-to-day sort of week-to-week basis. But yeah, it is what it is. And you know, it's a degree, so I'm happy with that.
Yeah, well done. Yes, there's not too many tennis players with degrees, so it was great that you got one.
Have you seen the Functional Tennis Saber? It's the ultimate sweet spot training tool developed by me, Fabio Molli, helping you focus and narrow in on the areas you need to work on. It helps improve a range of skills crucial for improving your performance on the court: footwork, spacing, timing, ball watching, and more. It's used by ATP and WTA top 10 players in academies all over the world, and you'll also see it on your local tennis court. It's shipping worldwide, and if you want to find out more, visit our website at functionaltennis.com.
And tell me, so you decided I'm going to go doubles. And what's from those early days on the doubles tour and today? So you had early success early on and you've success now. What's changed? What's the biggest changes in the game?
I think the variety or styles of play. I think back, you know, maybe before I was even sort of on the tour, majority of players, you know, serve volley, maybe a little bit of I formation. But most players are coming forward to play in a very sort of serve volley style of play, bit of craft, bit of finesse. But as the game has progressed, you know, through my career, I found power, you know, the technology of the rackets, a little bit less technical, a little bit more physical has become more apparent. You know, the technical side of things, people are, you know, a lot closer to the net rather than sort of, you know, sort of center of the service box. People are literally on top of the net. So reactions are fast. Again, the variety of styles playing against, you know, guys who don't want to be at the net. You know, there's a lot of, you know, South American players, you know, Central European players that serve, stay back. And you have to have a lot more emphasis on tactics and a variety of tactics. So, you know, you go into one tournament and you could play a variety of styles in the four matches, let's say, you know, playing an ATP 250. You might come up and get into a totally different style day after day. And there's a lot more singles guys playing the game these days. Maybe not necessarily right at the top end of the singles guys. But again, you know, you can still come up against Rafa Nadal and he'll be, you know, super motivated to win in a Masters Series event. You know, he's gone on to win different events. You know, he's done well at Olympics in doubles. I think, did he win gold medal with Mark Lopez? So these guys are great. I mean, Federer and Wawrinka, they're gold medalists in doubles. So, you know, these guys are all capable of playing good doubles. And if they do play, you know, it's tough to play against them. You know, Andy Murray's shown recently that he can play great doubles, and they're just great tennis players. So playing against these guys, it's, you know, it's almost like you feel a bit of an honor to play against these guys, and especially doing well against them. You know, there's such a variety of style, and the game is faster, harder than ever before, I think. And it's difficult as we, you know, you see some of the guys. I mean, I think Leander Paes is nine years older than me, and, you know, huge credit to him, knowing how my body feels going onto a tennis court and how he's able to compete still at the, you know, a great level, 9 years older than me. I can't imagine how my body's going to feel in 9 years time. I certainly won't be playing tennis at that sort of this level. So huge credit to that. I'm going to put my foot down now and saying in 9 years time, it's not going to be the case. So, you know, the variety of styles, you know, the way the game has developed over the years is amazing. And it's you know, as a fan of the sport, it's great to see. And you sort of love sort of working out and playing against these different ways and advancing your own game to sort of match up against these players. And it's a great feeling when you come off with a win and it's a game style. Or let's say if I'm playing on clay against clay court specialists and you get the victory, you know, they're things that mean a lot to me. It might just mean one match match to another person, but I take a lot of, you know, a lot of big things from them type of wins, and it's a nice feeling, really good feeling.
I've got to quickly mention college tennis again. Some of the guys I play with here who've been to college, I don't know, the Niall Fitzgeralds, Kieran Fitzgeralds, the Kluskies, Colm O'Brien, McGee's, all these guys, which I'm sure you know, if they all come back being great doubles players, just instinctively great doubles players. Do you notice that the guys who do go to college, because they play so much doubles and are taught how to play the game, are actually really good doubles players compared to the guy who's just played singles and then takes up doubles once they're 22, 23 at the pro level?
From a singles perspective on the tour, a lot of guys, they play doubles sort of to get a bit of court time on the big courts before they play their singles matches. But over the course of a year, there's very little actual specific doubles practices. And that's fine because they're obviously spending so much time on court focusing on their singles game. It's, you know, it's difficult for them to sort of, you know, pick and choose when to practice their singles compared to doubles. In college, we had, you know, a weekly plan where, let's say, Monday, Tuesday was singles. Wednesday was just a doubles day. Thursday was, you know, a bit more of a quiet day leading into sort of the weekend when you compete against other universities. There was specific doubles practices. So every singles player that went to college would at least come away with a better understanding or a little bit more positive outlook on their doubles game, because one, you know, they spend an awful lot more time serving and volleying. So they establish their game style or the ability to spend more time at the net. They have to be at the net when their server is playing. The fear factor is sort of, you know, that they're a bit more relaxed being at the net because they're dealing with so many more tennis balls coming at them in a more stagnant position at the net. So, you know, all areas of playing doubles, they're practicing more and more. And a lot of these guys just don't spend enough time there because they just don't practice it enough. You know, you see an awful lot of good singles guys, you know, they play great, great tennis, but you can really pick on them at the net because they just don't spend enough time there, or they don't believe their reactions are quick enough. You know, if they just spend half an hour a week, you know, just training doubles, they would realize that they do have the ability to do it. We're all capable of, you know, their hand-eye coordination reacting quick enough. If they trained it a little bit better, they would have a little bit more, you know, a better outlook on their own doubles probably performance and their ability to sort of help their doubles partners out at sort of certain times. And again, they don't even need to be better players. They just need to maybe understand their core positioning a little bit better, because an awful lot of them sort of hide, you know, if their partner is serving, they tend to hide close to the tramline, a little bit like social doubles, because they think that they don't feel like they can help their partner and they don't want to make a mistake, but they're actually playing into the hands of their opponents because they're giving them too big of a gap to sort of, you know, it makes it easy for the returner to sort of find the space. And a good doubles team will always be two singles guys who don't work or don't have the ability to sort of help each other out around the net area. So college tennis is great for that. And I've seen it firsthand, a lot of singles guys that go to college who've actually enjoyed playing doubles because they didn't realize they were good at it. And they, again, as you say, they all come away with a better outlook on doubles, and they're all very good doubles players.
That's what I've seen here, just from at a lower level of playing, like league matches and club matches and local competitions. I've really noticed that. But what you spoke of reaction, what's the best hand-eye coordination drill that you find?
For me, it's a simple drill. It's just spending time there, getting balls nailed at you as fast as you can, because the quicker you have balls hit at you, you know, a lot of balls in a match don't get hit as hard as what you can recreate in a practice. So if you're practicing, let's say Barcelona play football at a very high tempo, you know, a lot of teams struggle to play against them because they're just not ready for that tempo and that level of fitness. It's same in, you know, when you're practicing volleying. If you right on top of the net and you get a ball fed at you, you know, a faster speed than what you play at, when it comes to the match, that becomes second nature to you and becomes, I wouldn't say easy, because you still have to make decisions quite quickly, but you at least feel comfortable with the fact that, you know, well, nothing's faster than practice. I'm going to be very comfortable at taking up a good position at the net, helping my partner out, and I've trained it enough where I'm able to react quick enough. Now, you will make mistakes, don't get me wrong. It's not going to be every volley is going to be perfect. And there are going to be guys, if you know, you time your split step slightly wrong, you could potentially get hit. But you get hit as long as you're not getting hit in the eye, or, you know, a little bit, you know, a couple of spots on the body that can be quite painful. You can get over it. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, they almost look scared of the ball, but reality is, you know, we're all men here. We should be able to deal with getting hit. It's one of them things. It's just spending time there, just having the confidence to just be there, you know, having a coach, you know, nailing these balls at you. And it also helps with the fact that if you know, playing doubles with someone more consistently, you're able to time the split step a little bit better and you know sort of the rhythm of the serve. It's almost an unconscious knowledge of when the ball is coming from your partner. You know the rhythm of the serve, how many ball bounces they generally do. You know, if you're playing with a different guy every week, everybody has a different tempo of their serve. So it takes a little bit of time to get used to. But playing with someone with a little bit more consistency, you tend to be able to time the split step better, because if you get the split step wrong and you're midair and the ball's coming at you at 100 mile an hour, if you're in midair still when you're split stepping, the ball is going to hit you because you use the ground to get out of the way. Yeah, the best thing I could say is just spend more time there.
And if you're a player out there who doesn't have a coach, like most of us, just find the hardest hitting player in your tennis club and get him to just hit the ball at you as hard as you can. It's quite an easy one to work on.
You don't even necessarily have to have someone, you know, at the baseline. You can have someone at the net feeding, you know, very close contact. The closer they are, the less time, reaction time you have, but you just train the eyes to sort of pick up the ball. Technically, obviously, you want to be as reliable as possible. I'm playing shots now that I would never consider playing. I'm playing, you know, double-handed forehands just because you don't have that much time to get your racket into play. So you're doing whatever you can to get, your strings on the ball. Let's say you have four reflexes in a match. They could be the four most important points of the match. Small margins in doubles, when that point becomes, you know, apparent, it could be 8-all in the match tiebreak that's the most important point of the match. And that reflex volley means everything. So if you can get that ball back in play, you can change a match. You can change the momentum of a match just based on one point. And it's key. If you can have comfort around the net, you can win a match based on one or two shots.
As the most important thing is that you're putting into practice, so you're improving. So court on time is important. I'm not sure if you've seen Jamie Murray's YouTube channel, Ken. He launched it a couple of months ago, and it's actually fascinating. Like, his doubles drills and what he says is really pinpoint, and I think it's top level stuff, but he breaks it down really well. And I'm going to link to it in the show notes here. But I think every tennis player should be checking it out, because I think there's a lot of good value in it. You've seen it, have you?
I've seen bits of it, yeah. I mean, I can't say I've seen all of it, but I mean, I obviously have known Jamie for quite a long time. So even though I might not necessarily have seen all the different things, I pretty much know most of the things that he will do and the things that he works on to be the player that he is. Jamie's, for me, is considered one of the best doubles players in the world, one of the best net players in the world. His coverage around the net, his calmness around the net, which probably ties into the drill that I talked about, something that we did a long time ago when Louis Caillet first came on the scene with the LTA and the British doubles guys. You know, if you spend as much time at the net as we've done over the years, you know, you will always find a way to sort of become an established good volleyer. He does have some fascinating drills that I've seen. You know, he's an astute doubles player with so much craft around the net, and it's really great to watch, because volleying is an art and there's not enough of it in the game anymore, especially on the singles. It's so nice to see players that still have that sort of finesse to play certain classic volleys, and he does it so well as well.
Who's the one player you played against, so he's probably played multiple times, who's just has the most unbelievable touch and finesse, can do anything with the ball? Is there one player that stands out for you?
Jamie is definitely one of them. I mean, his court position is fantastic. So, you know, he's got a great wingspan. He's a big guy. He places the ball around you, because you no matter how good of a doubles player you are, if the player that plays against you finds gaps and he's able to get the ball to sort of hit them spots, it doesn't matter what you're doing. You know, you're just not going to get there. I've always enjoyed watching Leander Paes play. You know, he's an established great volleyer. He's a little bit more of a, you know, he can play some really big power shots. You know, he's some drive volley. I mean, at times he's similar to Jamie, but in other ways he isn't. He has got so much ability around the net, and he's, you know, he's a character as well, and he's very fun to watch. But as the years have gone by, as I say, it's a little bit more of a power game now, so it's more of the older players that, you know, back in the day, that have a little bit more of the feel type shots that it's always enjoyable to watch.
I did notice Jamie, the few times I've seen him play, the amount of lobs he hits is actually incredible. I know there's a lot of lobs in doubles now, it's changed, but he was just hitting so many in big moments, and he was winning the majority of points. Was just amazing to see how crafty he was at them.
Yeah, and I'm not sure in terms of how many compared to other top players that play lobs, but Jamie must be up there in the top five players for lobbing. He just has that ability to sort of find the back you know, 2 feet of the court. But again, going back to sort of spending time close to the net and dealing with the pace, you know, he probably practices his return lob more than anybody. Yeah. So there's a reason why he's so productive with it. It's a part of his armor that he uses to the best of his ability. It's a really difficult shot to deal with. The doubles game these days is a power game. So if you have a guy who serves big, a lot of the time the guy at the net is trying to cover a big part of the court and they move forward to get close to the net to sort of knock off the volley. You know, playing against someone like Jamie, you know, he has the ability still to hit an aggressive cross-court shot, but he also has a very similar technique to where he opens the racket up and then he flicks the lob and he then comes forward, and him and his partner, you know, obviously Neil now, they're in the ascendancy when you should be the attacking team as the server. You can get forward and he puts an awful lot of pressure on the server to get it out of his reach. It's a difficult thing to do. And, you know, on his day, he can really find, as I said, the back 2 feet of the court and put himself in such a great position at the net that, you know, it's a dangerous sort of game to play against.
I'd say many guys still have nightmares over those lobs.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to move on to a bit, I think, of more fun tennis. I don't know too much about it, but I've seen you post about it the past few years. I'm not sure exactly how many years you've been playing, but the World Team Tennis looks like a lot of fun. Looks like there's a lot of English guys playing now. Tell me more about World Team Tennis.
Yeah, I mean, I've played 2 full seasons. I played one season where I only had a couple of matches to sort of give me an introduction to the World Team Tennis format. And it was a real eye-opener when I first started. But again, even though I struggled in the first year, I played a couple of matches for the Washington Castles. It opened my eyes to the team environment again, sort of reminded me of college tennis. And it was a really relaxed format in terms of there's no ranking points available. You get paid, you know, as a salary to play for the 3 weeks. And the format is really interesting. It's a very fast-paced sport. You have a men's singles, women's singles, men's doubles, mixed doubles, and women's doubles. And you all compete to 5, and it's a short format. So the amount of time spent on court in the matches individually is not that long. The overall, that the length of time that the matches take place, you're probably looking at a couple of hours. So it's great for the fans because there's a lot of intensity in terms of their interaction. You know, the short format means that there's a lot of more interesting points throughout the course of the match. And the overall feeling of it is excitement and fun. Even though it's not for ranking points, everybody wants to win. Everybody's looking to sort of, especially with the British doubles guys that sort of played, you know, we're competing every day. I played against my brother. Joe Salisbury was meant to play, but he's pulled out. So we had Luke Bambridge, Johnny O'Mara, a good friend of mine, Fabrice Martin, he's playing, Bruno Suarez. So every night, Matt Reed, he was playing for Las Vegas. I'm playing against friends every night. So there's a bit of, you know, the bit of a needle there that you want to beat your friends and have good fun with them guys. And, you know, it's difficult in some ways. We have 14 matches over 17 nights and you're traveling across America. So, you know, some of the flights are, you know, they're not short. You would travel in the morning, practice in the daytime, play the same day, and then do the same thing the next day. There's an awful lot of travel. A lot of players struggle with the format because, you know, if let's say, for instance, I mean, Feli Lopez was on my team and, you know, I'd played against him a couple of weeks prior at Queens and I don't really know the guy that well prior to playing World Team Tennis, but I found that his lifestyle of being a tennis player, he was dealing with something very unorthodox. Normally he would go to a tournament 3 days before. He'd feel, you know, very relaxed playing, you know, 4 days later, 3 or 4 days later, having played, you know, 3 or 4 practice sets, having, you know, no jet lag. He'd sort of recovered from the travel. But to put him in an environment where it's fast paced, you have to come out of the blocks quick, traveling 2 hours in the morning, or let's say up to 5 hours, you know, once you get to the airport, all that sort of stuff. Playing in that sort of environment, you know, you're playing away from home. So the crowd's on you. Your opponents are, you know, very comfortable playing in the home court advantage. He found it really difficult. It was a really eye-opening experience, and he's not the first and he won't be the last. People really struggle with the fact that they have to travel and play on the same day. And I'd had the experience of playing World Team Tennis, so I sort of knew what to expect. Your body isn't going to be perfect. You have to find a way to get yourself up for every match. The good thing is the matches aren't that long, as I said. So you sort of feel as though, you know, you're not really looking for a second wind because you don't need it. It's not like you're having to sort of play for 3 hours. It's a 15, 20 minute window where coffee becomes, you know, your best friend leading into a match. You know, you're playing in an environment where, you know, it's 75, 80, 90 degrees. You know, at least you feel physically warm. It would be tougher if you're playing in the UK in the winter time,
the summertime,
where your body's cold.
Yeah.
Or even in the summertime, yeah. So you're playing in really warm, nice environments. And it was something that I've really enjoyed to get away from the tour for 2 or 3 weeks. It's nice to obviously get paid pretty well for that time. And, you know, the first full year that I played for Orange County. We actually won the championship. So it also adds to the sort of excitement and enjoyment of playing in a team that I've had success. So I would advise everybody to give it a go, but it's not for everybody. I'd also say that.
I mean, you played for Orlando Storm this year, was it?
Orlando Storm, yeah. So yeah, Storm was coming, but unfortunately the Storm wasn't very good. We had a 4-10 record. But even though we've obviously lost 10 matches, quite a lot of them are close matches. You know, you're talking 2 or 3 points, you could have easily have won the match. It's difficult because everybody's very competitive and the results weren't great, but I still loved it. And I would hopefully get the chance to do it again next year.
Ken actually, bought Christmas jumpers from my Christmas jumper company about 5 years ago, maybe. He's probably the first ATP Tour player, apart from James Klusky, to wear a Christmas jumper, because James used to endorse him. And I know he gave jumpers to Freddie Nielsen and a few other, and to Fabrice Martin as well. They all got, James used to gift them all. He used to buy jumpers off me. And I was like, James, what are you doing with these? And he used to be gifting to even your coach in LSU. He got Christmas jumpers. Anywhere he went, he brought Christmas jumpers. It's like, this guy loves them. And no, then Ken bought some for his family. We even sent some, this is on my own back, we sent some to Judy Murray and for Andy and Jamie, but she wore it, but I never saw Andy. I know Andy wore a different Christmas jumper. It wasn't our one, but hopefully we'll get him in the future at some stage. We'll get some jumpers over to him. So I'm hoping we've a couple of new designs out this year, Ken. We'll have to kit out the family.
Absolutely, yeah. I've always been a big Christmas jumper fan. It was a really appreciative that we were able to get some jumpers back in the day. And the whole family buy into it, you know, Christmas Day, we're all kitted out and it's a tradition now. So hopefully long may it continue.
I actually got on to Wilson. I said, Wilson, what are the chances of putting together a Roger Federer Christmas jumper like Roger Federer, the Santa Federer? But they weren't entertaining. They said they can't mention Federer in any clothes or anything. They're rackets only. So that conversation ended there. And you probably know Nike or agents. You just can't speak to those guys. But I thought it would be a bit of fun, but it's not happening. So I'm going to end with this with, what advice do you have for dads, tennis player dads out there? What's the one piece of advice you can say, hey guys, this is important?
What advice could I give? I think it's important to know if sleep is the most important thing for you. I think maybe 2 hotel rooms could be an option for you if you can afford it. I think it's, on a day-to-day basis, if sleep, what gets you through a day, you know, it's very key that your son or daughter, who obviously might potentially wake up 2 or 3 times in a night, you need to be very aware that them type of things can have a massive effect, not necessarily for one day, but over the, you know, course of 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks into a trip, you've got to make sure that you get your sleep. Drink an awful lot of coffee. I think if you don't like coffee, I think try and find a way to enjoy it. And it gets me through my day. I have an understanding wife as well. You've got to be selfish when you're playing tennis, and it's very key to make sure that you get what you need to be productive.
Great. I'm sure there's Rome Bopana supply all you guys with coffee. He's probably there pumping the coffee. Try my coffee.
Well, I mean, I've seen it promoted and I've always asked him for his, I think it's called Squirrel. So I'm going to try to get one off him because I do love my coffee and I've heard a lot of good things about it. And he seems to have given a few of his samples away to some players. So I think Neil's got one as well, so maybe I'll be able to get one on this trip.
What's the plan for the next year? Keep playing or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to continue playing as long as I feel like I can compete at the, you know, the 250 level and above. I don't particularly want to go and play a challenger schedule anymore. I don't think I'm sort of in that sort of mind frame to drop down the level anymore. You know, if I can't, just from the perspective of making money, the ATP level is sort of where it's at. I feel like I've had a good enough year where, I mean, at least, you know, going into next year, I've got loads of points, so I'll have the ability to at least play through next year. But I won't be playing with Neil at the moment. It's a bit of a disappointment in that element because obviously I've got to start a new partnership. This week is a new start with Marcus Daniel, see how things progress. Looking forward to it. I mean, we've had a couple of practice sets so far and things seem to be good. But again, tennis is a funny sport. You just never know how things will go down the line. And hopefully, you know, I can end the year strong leading into what could be, you know, a very interesting 2020.
I met Marcus a few years ago at Wimbledon. He's a really nice guy. He's had a bit of a wrist injury, I think, which slowed him down, but he's had some great results. I'm sure Bodie is together. If you both gel, there'd be a lot of upsets on the way.
He's had a great year. He played a lot with Wesley Kuhlhoff. He's obviously had some injuries, as you said. He says he's a bit injury prone at times, but you know what? He seems to be fairly healthy right now, and long may that continue.
Great. Well, I'm going to wish you a great end to the season. This will probably air after the US the week two US Open. So I'm hoping you're still around there. And yeah, thanks a lot. It was great speaking to Ken and hearing a bit about you. We're hearing a lot about you, but really appreciate it. Thank you.
I've loved it. It's lived up to its expectation and I've really enjoyed it. So anytime. Cheers, mate.
Appreciate it. Thank you. What a great conversation from Ken there. It can't be easy being away from your three kids for so many weeks of the year, but Ken handles it really well. And great insight into the doubles game. Really hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please leave a comment in the podcast app that you're listening with. Have a great week, and we'll be back with a new episode next week. Goodbye.